I'm happy to answer questions or hear disagreements or anything people say. I don't know how we're going to do this. If there's a microphone so others can hear it, maybe I could we can avoid. Yep.
I'm up here.
Yep. Yeah.
Hey, it's Don.
Hello.
I just thought I would make a comment. I got a call today from a gal who lives north of town. Her son lives in, older son lives in Arizona, and he just said that he's made the decision to join the Marines with the plan of getting out of the Marines as quickly as possible so that he can get involved with Blackwater, because guys in his age group are realizing that the future holds these two possibilities. You'll either be the killed or the killers.
Huh. I mean, that's, I think most people could hear you there. I mean, what I would say about that is that, you know, friends of mine who were in the military in Iraq and Afghanistan said that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of headhunting that goes on where you have special forces guys being recruited to join these companies. For other people, I mean, look, if you can get paid 5-6 times or more what you're getting in the military, you go, the taxpayers pay for your training, and then you join up and get a 6-figure salary to work for these companies. These companies are taking advantage also of the economic situation in this country in cases like that of your friend. I think that's a sort of devastating thing to hear, that someone would join the military then to go on and work for Blackwater. I suppose it makes sense in a capitalist way, though.
And his milieu of friends are thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
So that's an undercurrent.
I mean, that's not even to mention the morality of or justice of it, but... Yeah, that's disturbing. Thanks for drawing that to our attention.
I wonder if you'd comment on the scene and scenario in the film Children of Men, which are you familiar with?
Yeah.
Any comments briefly, if you would? And I also wonder if you could make some comments on what might be happening with the National Rifle Association. In times like this, I from time to time, I've jokingly said for a year or two or three now that I'm thinking of joining the NRA, and so when you talk like you're saying about federalized mercenaries paid with taxpayer dollars, I wonder, is the NRA reacting? Do you have any sense of if they're reacting to this sort of thing, and if they got it, they're beginning to cast an eye that way, and becoming uneasy, and if there are people like me, maybe saying a little less jokingly every week or month things like that?
Well, I mean,
first the film, if you would.
Well, on Children of Men, did you come to see Roger Ebert? No, I'm just kidding. No, I don't. I'm just joking with you. I don't know that I have any comments on the movie Children of Men. I mean, I saw it. I don't know that it made that big of an impact on me. I'm familiar with it, and I don't know exactly which part of it, the acting or the rest of it, that you'd want me to comment on. But the serious question.
They were herding people into a great big compound, and I turned to Jan,
right.
And I said, "Oh, Homeland Security."
Okay, that you should have said that.
They rolled upward, and here's a sign.
Yeah.
Land security. That.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot. I mean, I think a lot of people are very deeply concerned and outraged in this country at what they see as a closing in of the gates on anything resembling actual freedom of assembly, freedom of expression. And I think we certainly have seen in the history of this country times when people have been systematically targeted and hunted down and persecuted because of their political beliefs. And the more powerful these domestic institutions become, I think, the greater threat to our liberties. Whether we would see a scenario like that happen, I wouldn't be able to say. I think that the state of the resistance in this country right now to those in power is such that they don't even need to do to put anybody, hurt anybody into anything anywhere, because you know, they're in total control. They're winning right now, and they're winning primarily because people are either politically pacified or have been pacified by the economic situation, which makes it very difficult for people to find the time or energy or resources to actually be out in the streets. If we saw an actual in-the-streets resistance movement in this country, I think we would see it responded to very forcefully by those in power. And I definitely think that that's why it's important for all of us to be vigilant in watching these laws that are being passed that ultimately would make it easier to implement systems of repression very quickly that could be used on a widespread scale. As to the second part of your question, I think it's an interesting one. I hadn't really thought about it in the context of the NRA. My two cents of reaction, for what it's worth, is that, you know, I think that as a political body, the NRA has traditionally represented, you know, supporting the Republicans for the most part. And I think that they have really used some people's belief in the Second Amendment to forward a much narrower political agenda. And I think that that the political leadership of the NRA is not necessarily representative of the reasoning that some people engage in to join the NRA or to speak publicly in favor of gun rights. I wouldn't look to the NRA to be taking the lead on this at all. I think that some people, you know, within the NRA leadership would view these companies as their allies because they view them as people that will be defending spaces where guns can be used and the right to bear arms. I wouldn't look to the NRA as a sort of place where civil liberties are going to be upheld and defended, as much as I think some people want to believe that. That's just not what that institution or organization is, but I understand the premise behind your question. Perhaps, is there a woman that wanted to ask a question somewhere? Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just wanted you to go over if any Blackwater employees have ever been prosecuted for unprovoked murder of innocent civilians. I mean, is there any history that they've never been successfully prosecuted?
Right. Yeah, Blackwater has been in Iraq since August of 2003, as far as U.S. government documents are concerned. And not a single Blackwater operative has ever been charged or prosecuted for any crime whatsoever under any system of law, despite the fact that Blackwater forces carried out the single greatest massacre of Iraqi civilians in Baghdad on September 16th, 2007, when they gunned down almost 20 Iraqis and wounded 24 others. Not a single person has been charged, despite the fact that a U.S. military investigation labeled it a criminal incident and said that it had every indication of excessive shooting. And the military, U.S. military expressed surprise at the caliber of weapon being used. The FBI said that 14 of the 17 Iraqis that were killed that day were killed as a result of unjustified and unprovoked gunfire. The individuals who carried out the killings, we understand, are under some sort of a investigation by the Justice Department, but the way that, U.S. law is written, as for what it's worth, covering these companies, it's unclear if they are even going to be able to successfully prosecute them under existing U.S. laws. These guys will have very sophisticated lawyers, so you have a double problem here. You have an absolute lack of political will on the part of those who run the Justice Department, the least impartial Justice Department in the history of this country, to prosecute the crimes of employees of a politically connected firm. And then on the flip side of it, you have laws that are written to immunize preemptively these companies from any effective prosecution. It's a climate where impunity and immunity go hand in hand. We're here now in Washington State. You have as far as my story is concerned, you have a very famous resident of your state, a guy named Andrew Moonen, who is from Seattle, alleged to have shot and killed a bodyguard to the Iraqi vice president, Adel Abdelmahdi, on Christmas Eve 2006. This individual worked for Blackwater, was allegedly drunk in the green zone, stumbling from a party, encountered a guard, pulls out his gun and shoots the guy repeatedly, killing him. Blackwater then conspired with the U.S. State Department to sneak him out of Iraq and send him back to the United States. Within months, Andrew Moonen was rehired by another company. Blackwater fired him. He was rehired by another war company and deployed back in the Middle East working for them. He now works at a prison here in Washington State and walks around a free man. And to date, no charges have been brought against him, despite the fact that he committed what the Iraqi government, recognized by the Bush administration, says was the murder of one of the bodyguards to the Iraqi vice president. I mean, we'd be talking about neighborhoods disappearing in Iraq if a bodyguard for Dick Cheney was shot and killed in Texas by an Iraqi. And yet this man, Andrew Moonen, walks around as a free individual. Those are two of several stories of Blackwater engaging in criminal conduct, violent conduct, cold-blooded killing, where nothing has happened to them whatsoever. In fact, it's not just Blackwater. In 5+ years of occupation of Iraq, not a single armed contractor has been prosecuted for any crime whatsoever. and there have only been 4 prosecutions of unarmed contractors. Compare that to the fact that about 70 U.S. soldiers have been court-martialed on murder-related charges, and it becomes a very stark comparison. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm just curious if you see any hope in the House not passing the bill yesterday, the bailout bill, and the fact that hopefully Americans are sort of waking up to some of the cracks in the system, and their constituents, you know, responding to these congressmen and these House of Representatives people.
Right, I'm glad you brought that up.
If this crisis, if you see that affecting the actual coffers of these companies, these other
As to the first part of your question about hope in the rejection of the president, I'm going to restate it. The first part of the question was if there's any hope in the fact that the Congress voted against the president's bailout package yesterday. And then I'll answer that, and then I'll say your second question and answer that. As to the first question, I think I found it very inspiring to see the Congress actually stand up for the people for once. Now, I question the motives of the you know, many of the Republicans who voted against it. I found it interesting that they did it. But I was just watching Congressman Dennis Kucinich before I came over here talking on MSNBC, and Kucinich voted against it for the right reasons and for principled reasons. And I think that what we're going to see is a minority of people in the Congress who are actually going to try to use this as an opportunity to do some business for the people. And to stop this socialism for corporations while leaving those of us who are not suited up and on Wall Street out in the cold. And Kucinich actually gave a statistic that most of you have probably read, that we're each going to be responsible, in theory, for about $2,300 of this bailout. Kucinich is saying it's closer to $7,000 per person, man, woman, child, that it's closer to $7,000 per person. I think ultimately that they're going to pass some kind of a revised version of it. But the fact that it got voted down caused shockwaves on Wall Street, and I think it was a good thing. What I found really inspiring over the past week was the spontaneous demonstrations that happened across the country. I mean, I live in New York, and emails just started floating around for people saying, everybody in the streets, bring your junk to Wall Street to leave there and say, bail me out. And people had great, I mean, thousands of people actually poured into the streets in New York, and there wasn't a single sign for Obama or McCain or anything like that. It was angry people who were coming out in the streets and saying, I'm not going to take this anymore. Happened again yesterday. People poured into the streets. I think the more we see of this, and some people had these great signs, like this one kid said, I had a 4.0 GPA, I'm $90,000 in debt and unemployed, bail me out. And so someone else had a sign that, pardon my language here, but had a sign looking up at the executives, staring down at the protesters that said, jump, you sir. And it said, don't bring your golden parachute. No, I think that it was a moment in time where Congress inadvertently actually did something for the people, and I think that it's our, at this point it's our responsibility to be in the streets over this. I mean, this is going to affect everyone in this country for years and years to come. That's the second part of your question, and I'll repeat it. He was asking, is it actually going to affect the coffers of these companies like Blackwater's and others? No, in fact, I think it's going to even further strengthen these companies, because once this bailout happens, whatever version of it we end up with, whatever crumbs they're able to push off the table of the powerful at the end of the day, what it's going to do is really codify or solidify this system where the corporations have infinitely more rights than you and I or any of us in this room. That's the real message that's being sent right now. Where was all the discussion of bailing out everyone who lost their homes because of predatory lending? There was no discussion of it. It didn't exist. It didn't happen. When this happens, though, it's, oh my God, we have to do something, because the most important people in society, whose names are actually a series of letters followed by periods, they're more important than you and I. Let's let other people get in on the action here.
Yeah, my first trip to Washington, D.C. was for the 1970 war moratorium, so I know you speak the truth on almost everything you said, so there are no issues there. I have two questions on the way forward. One for what do we do here? What do we do on the barricades when we do show up? I mean, we can stop a bailout, but that's a pretty simple
thing. I don't know about
thing.
That one. But.
Well, I mean, we modified it, you know, and that's about all we can do, really, is modify it. So how should we modify it? That's not your... But bailiwick, I don't. But I'm wondering if you have some ideas regarding a way forward. You know, because you know you're right about Obama. I mean, he's trying to get elected. The population outside of this room and other rooms that you will encounter, basically, are oblivious to this. You know, so there's some really education that needs to be done. But I also want to throw in. I spent this time last year. I was in Kabul. The summer before, I was in Baghdad, so I understand what you're talking about. I was in Denver, you know, and I, you know, you're right on. You know, first time I ever saw a fully armed, you know, guy with a, you know, sitting there in a white van, white armored van. You know, I mean, it's scary what's happening. You know, so, but what do we do? And I want to say something about Kabul and Afghanistan first before. I mean, about Baghdad and Afghanistan, because, you know, really, we are going to have to deal with al-Qaeda cells out there, and we're going to have some kind of a plan for dealing them, but we're yanking people out, you know, so we've got to have something to do about that, and we also have to have some idea about what we want to do, and one of my ideas is very simple, is, you know, one of the first things we need to get out on the barricades about is take away the speech rights of corporations, you know, that's not saying a little bit strong. We need to reverse the 1800s Supreme Court decision that corporations have exactly the same rights as we do. I mean, that's not fair, and it's created this environment that you've described. Mm. So that's one thing. Now, what are some of the other ways, and what do we do about al-Qaeda?
Okay. Thanks for your question. I mean, on the issue of what should we do, I mean, the area that I'm working on is primarily the issue of these out-of-control private corporations and the increased domination they maintain over various aspects of our lives, almost all aspects of our lives. And what I on that front, and I'll answer that first, on that front, I think that we have to take groups of people that are mobilizing in their local communities around the country, because I've learned from traveling over these past 2 years that there are a heck of a lot of people that are doing great things in small numbers in communities across the country. And I think it's a matter of trying to network more with people and build it up and have national days of action where we are concentrating our efforts locally in our communities, wherever these companies rear their heads. I think we should build national days of resistance against war profiteering corporations and target these companies. In the case of these banks and other corporations, none of us ever live too far from some representation of these corporations, and I think it's a matter of taking our action to these companies themselves. In the bigger picture, though, on the political issue, as maybe vague and naive as it sounds, we have to challenge the two-party system. Once again in this country, we are faced with a crucial question that is dividing the anti-war movement in this country. You have the Obama campaign literally swallowing huge portions of the anti-war movement and co-opting it for political purposes, despite the fact that the platform of the Obama campaign runs directly contrary to those who want an actual withdrawal from Iraq. I say that because we should have learned after the Democrats swept both houses in 2006, we should have learned the true nature of that party. This is not an opposition party. At best, it's a loyal opposition party. And I don't say that to take away from people. I understand why a lot of good-hearted people, smart, sharp, dedicated people are voting for Obama. I'm not trying to tear people down here. What I'm saying is that until we have the political bravery one of these election cycles to actually stand up and say, I'm going to vote for someone who actually represents what I believe in, the system is going to continue. And so, well, I mean, we could start a whole discussion. I'll just put it this way. There are a lot of people that ran for president this year, and I think that some of them are phenomenal candidates, and I think others are rascals and would-be criminals, and some of them are actual criminals. So I think focusing on two issues and however they manifest themselves in our communities, the issue of corporate dominance of our lives, and then the issue of the one-party system, which is a war party and a corporate party, On the issue of Al-Qaeda, you're raising something here that actually is a very complicated question. I think that what's unfortunate is we have two prime candidates running for president who both have adopted the myth that Al-Qaeda is the greatest threat on planet Earth to peace and stability. That is false. And in Afghanistan, I'll start with Iraq first. There was no such thing as Al-Qaeda in Iraq before the United States was there. The connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq before the invasion was Washington. Because in the north of Iraq, you had a small Al-Qaeda cell, Ansar al-Islam, operating out of the U.S.-controlled section in Iraq. Those who gave something called Al-Qaeda any role in Iraq currently reside at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue or show up there every day for work right now. They're the ones responsible for whatever people call an Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. They're the ones responsible for Iranian tremendous influence now in Iraqi politics and Iraqi affairs. In the case of Afghanistan, I interviewed Representative Marcy Kaptur in Denver, the longest-serving woman in the U.S. Congress. She's on the Appropriations Committee. And she is incredibly sharp on Afghanistan. And I said, Representative Kaptur, if Obama is elected president, what do you think he should do in Afghanistan? And she said, I think he should call up the Russians and ask them what he should do. Now, Marcy Kaptur is not, a flaming leftist. And she wasn't just saying that as a rhetorical device. The point she was making is that the U.S. occupation of these countries, the U.S. aggression, is flypaper for these types of organizations, for those who wish to do harm to others. They give them a reason for being. And I think that we need to start a discussion not about how can we target this cell and pull out fingernails over here, and how can we stick bamboo slits into someone's fingernails here and find a secret prison after the one in Poland gets shut down to take people, but actually start to think of what would a just foreign policy look like. And once we start playing their game, that's a slippery slope. I don't see Afghanistan as a threat to the United States. And I think if the United States were to leave Afghanistan, I think that it would be a much better situation than the United States being there. And Pakistan, the United States has supported the most repressive elements within the Pakistani government for many, many years. And what I think is unfortunate is that the United States has worked with some of the worst human rights abusing dictators on planet Earth, continues to do so, and it's absolutely bipartisan. Pakistan is a threat to Pakistanis primarily because of U.S. support and bolstering up of repressive leaders in Pakistan. Anyway, thank you for your comments and questions.
You're listening to a speech by Jeremy Scahill, the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. The speech was recorded at the Bing Theater in Spokane on Tuesday, September 30th, 2008.
Hi, Jeremy, it's Kelly. One disagreement, I don't think we have a two-party system, I think we have a one-party system. Democrats and Republicans. Secondly, two statements. If people want to understand anything about the behind the scenes of the financial situation, I would say just study the word derivatives. The subprime is a red herring in the whole thing, I believe. Secondly, you mentioned about corporatism. Mussolini had a word for corporatism, and it's called fascism. We are stepping out of the slope very quickly. We're not already in the slide. I have two questions about Iraq. How did the soldiers feel about all the depleted uranium that's used? It will make everyone sick forever, regardless of whether they come home unscathed or not. And do any of them ever talk about the backwards flag, this gold fringe on the right shoulder that they wear? Our flag is not backwards. Our flag is the stars on the left, stripes on the right.
That's not true.
That's not true. Okay.
No, when it's on a mail truck, if it's on one side, the stars are always to the front and the stripes behind.
Okay, so there's no meaning to that. Okay, and the gold fringe, no meaning also, sir?
Well, the first part of what you,
Well, let's save the discussions between the audience for later, please.
Was there any feeling by the soldiers? More importantly, forget the flag for the moment. We can disagree about that or talk later in the lobby. What do they feel about the depleted uranium? Depleted uranium lasts 4.6.
Yeah. So the question is about the depleted uranium and the view of soldiers. I mean, the use of depleted uranium in the Gulf, beginning with the 1991 Gulf War, and the heavy bombing of Iraq and the surrounding area, and then the continuation of the use of those munitions through the 1990s, has been one of the most covered-up stories in this country. The health impact of it, both on U.S. soldiers who were involved with deploying and using those weapons systems, in some cases wearing armor with depleted uranium in them, using depleted uranium munitions and dropping depleted uranium bombs, but also the civilians who live on the other side of it. If anyone here, and I'm sure there are people here who traveled to Iraq during the 1990s, saw what Iraqi hospitals looked like and congenital malformations that didn't exist in medical journals, and I traveled in many Iraqi hospitals, you would understand what depleted uranium does to people for generations to come. I think, unfortunately, many soldiers who serve in the military are completely unaware of the impact or effects of depleted uranium. In fact, I think it was more discussed, say, 10 years ago than it is right now, and it's a very important issue, one that's going to have serious health implications for particularly people in the military and people that have been on the other side of the barrel of the gun of U.S. policy. So thanks, Kelly, for asking that.
We have two people still in the balcony who've been waiting for a while. Here and here.
I do want to make sure there's gender balance, so if women do want to ask questions. So.
Okay. Let's go to the woman on the... in the corner there in the balcony.
No, okay.
I'd like to know when the point where the turret was, when Blackwater got their textbooks into our financial system. Was it legislation that was passed, or was it a serious situation under this administration? Is there a point that you can talk about? Is there a law? Is there legislation?
Just so I could understand, you're saying at what point was Blackwater able to sort of insert itself? I couldn't hear you so well. Into the economic?
Yes. Underpinnings of this country.
Into the economic underpinnings of this. Did people get the question? At what point? Is there some moment or something? Was it legislation or something else? Well, I mean, you know, the use of military contractors in general goes back many, many decades in this country. I mean, that the aftermath of World War II World War II itself was really when the modern military industry started to rise up into its present form, where you had companies that their entire livelihood was about manufacturing weapons of war, planes, tanks, bombs, guns, etc. And that's why Eisenhower gave his speech about the threat of unchecked power within the military-industrial complex. At the time he was talking about it, he was just talking about weapons systems. He wasn't even envisioning a system where you would outsource the actual fighting of the war. The U.S. has used private contractors primarily through the CIA for years, where they'll hire someone to do a job. They're off the books. It gives plausible deniability to the president or whoever orders the action to take place. But what you're asking about, how does Blackwater embed itself in the economic underpinnings of the country, really goes back to Dick Cheney's time as defense secretary during the 1991 Gulf War. I don't know how many people are aware of this, but Cheney hired, while he was defense secretary, a division of Halliburton, the company he would go on to head then in the 90s, hired a division of Halliburton to perform a study on how to privatize as much of the military bureaucracy as possible. And then Cheney paid Halliburton to effectively expand its own market, and then went on to become the leader of Halliburton in the 90s, while simultaneously working with the American Enterprise Institute and other neoconservative organizations to try to push for more belligerent policies that would ultimately benefit Halliburton. And Clinton got on board with this and actually gave contracts to mercenary companies to operate in the Yugoslav Civil War. Sent a company called Military Professional Resources Incorporated, a mercenary company, inside to train the Croatian military. The Croatian military then turned around and carried out Operation Storm and Lightning, expelling 250,000 Serbs from the Krajina and turning the tide of that war. Clinton was a major backer of it. He gave Halliburton major contracts. And then Rumsfeld and Cheney, when they got into office, wanted to take it to the next level. And they took a program that Clinton had started in Haiti in the 90s, to privatize a portion of the State Department's security wing and turned it into a private paramilitary force answerable only to the White House. And so, you know, Blackwater operates as an armed wing of the Bush administration. They're not under military command. And so this is really a creation of the State Department bureaucracy that was bolstered by the work of Cheney, Rumsfeld and Bill Clinton and his administration. Who oversees them? Well, in theory, we have a Congress that should be doing that. It took Henry Waxman 4 years as head of the Oversight Committee to get accurate information on one of Blackwater's contracts to figure out who they actually were working for when the four guys got killed in Fallujah. So in theory, you have State Department contract officers that are monitoring this. On paper, it looks like there's a hell of a lot of people that are monitoring it. In reality, no one's paying attention to it, except the accountants for these companies who count all their profits. So in theory, I mean, Congress should be overseeing this. It's a combination of political laziness and being stonewalled by the administration and the companies themselves.
I would like for Jeremy to be able to see the light at the end of this tunnel. And I have three people I know of that are waiting. If you want to get a question in here, I'd like for you to stand up and so I can tell what we're dealing with here. Now, Jeremy's not tired of taking questions, but a lot of the audience is. And so...
we can stop whenever you guys want.
Yeah. I would like to get some brief questions. I'd like to get some more coverage in here. And certainly the gentleman at the front of the balcony has been waiting a while. And the question over here, but I'll take two women after the man upstairs.
Okay. My question is, for all the horrific murders of children and adults in Waco, Texas, is that done by U.S. military personnel or by private contractors?
The question was about Waco and whether it was done by military personnel or private contractors. I mean, my understanding was that it was a combination of ATF, FBI, federal forces that raided Waco and burned that house. I'd never heard anyone talk about private contractors being involved with it. Next.
In the wake of the last three election cycles, having had the election called in Florida by Bush's cousin, the election really manipulated by Diebold in their manipulating of the machines, is anyone here aware of the fact that on STARS right now they're running a program called Uncounted that is something that on demand that you can watch that will explain how the elections have been pirated?
I believe that's Robert Greenwald's document, one of Robert Greenwald's documentaries.
Yes, it's absolutely amazing to watch. I've seen it twice now, and it's one of those things where you cannot comprehend why the American people are so completely in the dark. And I have a comment to make about the situation of our upcoming election, sham or otherwise. That we are in a situation where, and I'm asking you this, in fact, the next president, whomever he is, all of these things that you're talking about are funded by the American taxpayer, ultimately. So whoever gets in there, whether it's Obama or McCain or whatever, I'm hoping there's a difference between the two. What is your insight on what we can do about this?
Well, why don't we talk? I think that's going to be a very long conversation. I think we've talked a lot about that in general. I mean, I think what's more important than who you vote for on November 4th is what you're going to be doing on November 5th. Because regardless of which one of these guys is in office, my whole thing is I think people need to get back to going into the streets, get off the. I mean, that's the short answer.
A lot against both the Democratic and Republican candidates for this election, but and I think that you may have given some people the idea, not intentionally, that you know maybe they should vote Green Party or Libertarian in this election.
I think it'd be great if people vote Libertarian, Green Party, Independent. I think people should vote for the candidate that they think most accurately reflects their belief system and not allow others or political pressure to dictate who they vote for. Look, if you like Bob Barr, more power to you. Go vote for Bob Barr. If you like Cynthia McKinney or Ralph Nader, vote for them. When you cede your political conscience to a politician or a pressure group, you've stopped participating in democracy, and you've started participating in letting someone else dictate your agenda. I mean, if one more person says to me, well, I just have to vote for Barack Obama because I can't be a part of McCain winning, okay, then you're not really participating in democracy. You're voting against McCain. That's fine. You're not voting for what you believe in. What you believe in is probably more accurately reflected by someone else. Maybe it's strategic for some people, but you know, I think people should vote their conscience and for the candidate that most accurately reflects their belief system.
Where were you the last 8 years?
Me? Where was I the last 8 years? I was in Iraq. I was in Yugoslavia. I was in.
Vote your conscience. I mean.
Oh, you mean like where? Oh, I've been saying that. I've been saying that as long as I was eligible to vote. I've been doing that. I've never voted for a Democrat or a Republican in my life. I've always believed that those two systems don't represent. I don't think that they actually represent the best interests of the people of this country or the people of the world. And in 2004, I was very critically reporting on both the Bush and the Kerry campaigns. I thought that the Kerry campaign ran a very right-wing campaign. That was attempting to play to Bush's base and not to the base of people that were voting for Kerry. In 2000, I think that Ralph Nader ran a very effective and interesting campaign, and I think he energized a lot of people and was able to get what I think was a very respectable portion of the popular vote. I don't believe that voting for independent candidates loses elections for the Democrats. I think the Democrats lose elections for the Democrats.
Hi. Okay, up here. My name's Dr. Bill Dates. I was involved in Free Gaza movement this summer. We took to the sea lands and we broke a 41-year-old blockade.
Yeah, I followed that.
My point on that is that we witnessed what's becoming a concentration camp in Gaza, a slow concentration camp. When you look at the Israeli government and the American government and the Israeli and American economy, Both governments or our economy, the defense industries and the security industry are the only segment of the economy that seems to be thriving. Can you comment on the interconnection between Israel and the United States with regard to military-industrial complex?
I mean, the question in its essence was about the connection between Israel and the U.S. military-industrial complex. I mean, for a long time, Israel has been a testing ground for tactics used by U.S. forces, torture techniques, crowd control, urban warfare, as well as weapon systems. And, we have many Israeli trainers who have come to the United States to train police forces. The New York police forces received training from Israeli forces, and there's a tremendous amount of intelligence sharing, weapons exchanges. The Israelis have a very, very advanced system of repression, weapons systems, surveillance technology. They sort of pioneered the mainstreaming of targeted assassinations, and the United States has adopted those. One of the most chilling parts of Bob Woodward's new book is actually something that he refuses to expand on, and that is this invention that he claims that the U.S. forces have been using in Iraq to target resistance leaders that he says is the sort of modern equivalent to the invention of the tank and is being very cryptic about what it is. But the Israelis have been deeply embedded in the U.S. national security apparatus for a very, very long time. And I think it's a relationship that's going to endure. Once again, I think we see clearly, regardless of who's in power, it's very disturbing. The actions that we see the Israeli military and Israeli intelligence forces taking against the Palestinians, as well as against Israeli dissidents, being adopted and used in this country as well.
What is the status of Blackwater in North Idaho, and what can be done to oppose their intrusion?
Yeah. The question was, what's the status of Blackwater in North Idaho? I mean, as I said at the beginning, in Coeur d'Alene, Blackwater bought this company, the backup. That's the extent of it right now that we know. This is a company that is distributing DVDs to law enforcement agencies around the country to do training. There's another discussion, which I'm sure is part of what you're referring to, whether or not Blackwater is going to purchase land and open some kind of of a private facility that would, the stated mission of it would be to do training for law enforcement. They say it won't be military. My understanding is that there hasn't been a deal that's been signed yet, and that they haven't found land. I know there's a lot of theories floating around, a lot of rumors floating around. The fact is, I don't think anyone knows, and I was talking with a lot of the people working on this in Coeur d'Alene, what's going to happen with that. Blackwater seems to run into problems in every community that they go to, from small groups of people that turn into medium-sized groups of people that turn into, in the case of California, a statewide campaign against them. Is Bonnie Douglas here? Is folks? Oh, yeah, there's. Yeah. And so in San Diego, I mean, this was actually one of the success stories of this. Blackwater tried to open a facility not so different from the one that's been discussed in North Idaho. They tried to operate a private military base on 824 acres of land in Potrero, California, right near the U.S.-Mexico border, and a town of 850 people rose up against them. And they were people that were Democrats and Republicans, and some of them were libertarians and independents, and politics wasn't the issue there as much as people saying, I don't want my environment polluted, I don't want Humvees and helicopters and guns being fired at all hours, and I don't want noise and traffic, and I don't want a company with this kind of reputation coming into my neighborhood. And they rose up against Blackwater and made it untenable for Blackwater to stay there. And so Blackwater abandoned that project after pouring $1 million into it, and then went and opened a 64,000 square foot smaller facility in Otay Mesa, California, near the U.S.-Mexico border where Tijuana is. And so people are now targeting that and try to chase them out of that. But it's much smaller than it was supposed to be. And I would imagine that they'll find increased resistance here if they try to build that kind of a facility that's of a bigger nature in northern Idaho.
Bonnie is over here, by the way.
Oh, and this is Bonnie Douglas over here, who's one of the people that organizing there in Coeur d'Alene. And I'm sure she'd give people more information later if they wanted, or how you can get involved to help them with the work that they're doing 30 miles or so from you. Yeah, maybe one more here? Or
I got a quick question.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, it sounds like you're digging a lot of dirt on the government, you know, real important parts that are we're not supposed to know about. Have you been approached, intimidated, you know, talked to, received negative communication from any government authority on this?
I mean, I stopped reading a lot of my email a long time ago, and my phone has become a very painful device. When you do investigative work, particularly about corporations or about intelligence agencies, if you don't know what you're getting into, then you probably should not be an investigative journalist. So, you know, I know exactly who I'm investigating, and I know what I'm up against, and this is what I've chosen to do with my life. And I try to avoid what Phil Berrigan used to call the paralysis of analysis. You know, if you stop to think about what could be lurking in the shadows or who could do something to you, it's going to make it so that you don't do the work that you're supposed to be doing. And I think that's true of all of us in this country. These are times where it'd be very easy to recoil in fear and to feel paralyzed. I think it's important for all of us to be vigilant and keep our eyes on the ball, because those who believe in freedom are the ones that can save this country. And I think that's important for all of us, regardless of what contribution it is we're making to the fight for justice. So,
Mr. Scahill, my name is Carrie Wright. I am a spouse of a military retiree, and I'm very concerned about the report of the military unit that's going to be redeploying from Iraq to have active duty here in the United States. And I just wonder how that relates to your topic, and if you care to comment on that at all. Thank
you. I only heard someone mention this yesterday, so I haven't had a chance to really look at it closely to comment with any degree of accuracy. What I'll say in general about the concern you're raising there is that I think one of the most serious crises for domestic security of all of us is the expanded powers of the military in this country, particularly to operate on U.S. soil. And I think that using these companies is a backdoor way of doing that. And any notion of having active duty military being used in any sort of quote-unquote law enforcement capacity, I think would be a very clear sign of the path down which this country is headed, and I would be very much against it. I want to say one last thing, and then we can be done. And I'm happy to continue the conversation with people out in the lobby. You know, the folks that put this on today do a tremendous service here in Spokane, fighting for justice. And I want to thank all of the organizers for working on this tonight, all of you for coming out, those of you that stayed on. I'm sorry if it dragged on a bit. But I do want to encourage people who do happen to be one of those few Americans who have a little bit of money in their pockets that they can spare to try to donate it to the folks that do the kind of organizing that make events like this possible and take the time and sacrifice to go out into the streets. So you could see Rusty or others if you want to make an additional donation to any of these groups. I think it would be much appreciated. And I certainly appreciate all of you being here tonight and the work that you're doing. And thank you so much for having me and the kindness you've shown me. Thank you.
You've been listening to a speech by Jeremy Scahill, the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. The speech was recorded at the Bing Theater in Spokane on Tuesday, September 30th, 2008.